the topic that is on the bulletin board for today is religion and experience, faith. I see this as the first in a series of at least three presentations in which I would like to think with you about the interrelationship between our own personal experience and our personal religion or our personal theology. And they are not necessarily the same. I would like to do that by focusing with you on the nature of theological language and the way in which our theological or religious language and our private personal understandings of that language are influenced and determined by our experience. What's the value of this? Well, if what we do together has any worth as a method, and if our use of it is successful, then I would expect that each of us would be able to reflect more clearly on our own personal religious experience and on the theological language with which we express that experience. And that we would also not only be able to understand our own personal experience better, but we would be a little more open to understanding the religious experience of people who express their experience differently than we do. We would be more open to understanding that, and we might be more aware of the values of their expression of their experience for themselves, even though we ourselves would not necessarily find that their way of expressing it was more valuable for us. Now, if we then, and this would I hope be the third benefit, if we then are more clearly aware of the meaning of our own religious and theological expressions, and if we are more open to and more understanding of the religious and theological expressions of other people, then we would also be able to engage in more profitable, more meaningful conversation with one another. Although I also need to say that if we are successful, you may also find that religious and theological conversation begins to take a great deal more time and a great deal more energy. Because as we are successful, it would become less and less an exchange of formulas. Now, if that possibility interests you, maybe you may want to take the risk of staying for a brief discussion of some of the presuppositions of the method, and if that intrigues you, then during this week I'd like to try and apply the method to three basic religious categories. And I'd like to state them theologically first, so that you would like to use theological language, and then I'd like to use as code words, and then I'd like to use some code words from personal experience. But we want to look at our faith, free will and bondage of the will, and guilt and forgiveness. In terms of personal experience, I'd like to use the code words of trust and mistrust, of autonomy and shame, and of initiative and guilt. Some of you may recognize that particular set of code words as coming out of the personality, the theories of personality development, which have been presented in our time by Erik Erikson, and that is not accidental. I am using some of Erikson's categories as a way of looking at what I think are significant religious experiences. And I'll clarify that, why I make that choice, in just a moment. I'd like to lay out some presuppositions of what I am doing for you, and please don't hesitate to raise questions as we go along. My first presupposition is that theological language is language that uses analogy. I'm not trying to make a statement about all language, but simply to say that theological language works by use of analogies. All of our statements about God and about our relationship to Him and about ourselves in relationship to God are analogous statements. Statements that are phrased in terms of other relationships which are then applied to God. The Lord's Prayer is a series of such analogies. Our Father, thy name, thy kingdom, thy will. Those are words which have meaning for us, because fathers, kingdoms, names, wills are known to us from other experiences. Now, my presupposition is that all theological language operates with such analogies. Therefore, in order to understand theological language, it is necessary for us to explore the analogies of the person who is using the language. It is not to be taken for granted that my use of a word is based on the same analogy as your use of the word. So we may be both using the same word, but because we are using that word on the basis of different experiential analogies, we may be saying different things with the same word, or with the same thought, or with the same sentence. Like to try to illustrate that. If you can think of us as sitting in front of a huge screen, a white screen, of the kind that you show slides on, very large, in front of all of us. So we're all facing the same way, and the screen is in front of us. And behind us is a light, which is such a large light that the beam of light striking the screen goes past all of us. You know, it's not just a single shaft of light out in the middle of the room, but there's a great shaft of light going toward the screen. Now, as that goes toward the screen, each of us has in our hands a piece of cellophane of different color. Which we hold up into the light, between the light and the particular place on the screen that we are looking at. Now, if my piece of cellophane is red, what I will see on the screen is red. If your piece of cellophane is blue, what you will be seeing is blue. The light, the same. The screen, the same. The difference, and the point of the illustration here, is the difference in the color of the cellophane. Now, if you take another illustration, some of us wear glasses. When I put my glasses on, the world takes on a little different shape. I experience it one way without glasses and another way with glasses. And any of you who have attempted to borrow someone else's glasses know what I mean. And I suppose that those of you who are blessed with not wearing glasses have on occasion experimented with what it would like be like to wear glasses. And you've put on a friend's glasses. And things have not looked quite right. Now, that did not give you a very good experience of what it would mean for you to wear glasses, unless you happen to have a lousy doctor. Because they were not your glasses. But each of us, because of our experiences, have an individual set of glasses or lenses through which we view religion and theology. And these lenses are very individualized. They may be good lenses for us, or they may not be, but they inevitably determine the way in which we see the reality. And if the reality that we are trying to look at is the reality of God, the lenses through which we look will inevitably determine what it is that we see. Now, what these lenses that each of us carry around with us are, and this is my assertion, are the personal experiences which give meaning to our religious and theological language. Now those are simply assertions, and you may or may not find them to be true for you. Now, if however you are willing to operate for a moment with those assertions as true, and to spend some time in exploring what would happen if we would talk with one another about God as though they were valid assertions about the nature of theological language, we would then have to ask ourselves, given all of the data of experience which we have, what are those data that are significant for our understanding of our religious experience and for our theological language? And I would just for the moment suggest two kinds of experiences that are more likely to be significant. One are those experiences of relationships. Of personal relationships. My most obvious reason for asserting this is in the Bible itself. Because when the Bible describes God's relationship to man and man's relationship to God, it most often, the writers of the Bible most often use interpersonal language. Not always, but most often. There are impersonal descriptions of the relationship of God to man. The most well-known of which is, for example, the picture of God as a making pottery down the pottery shed here. And some things turn out well, and he says, we'll use those on the altar, and others turn out poorly, and they are either broken and destroyed, or they are used for the most common purposes. An illustration which historically has been the source of much difficulty for many Christians, and which I think is probably not, for most of them, many of us, the most useful or the most meaningful description of our relationship to God. So I would like to, for our purposes, assume then that the most useful and most important lenses for us are the lenses of interpersonal relationships. Secondly, that there are certain levels of interpersonal relationships that are more important than others. And these I would like to refer to as primal. Not simply in the sense of being primary, but as the sense of having precedence in terms of coloring our understanding of our relationships to God. Now you can perhaps understand that if you or someone whom you know has had a certain kind of interpersonal experience that has colored that person's understanding of other interpersonal experiences of the same kind. If you have bought a used car and your experience of the purchase of that used car was a poor one, or as if you felt you were given false information and exploited, and that your lack of knowledge was preyed upon, that you just got a bad deal, you would understand why it was that some people said that Richard Nixon was not the kind of person from whom you would want to buy a used car. Now, that would be meaningful to you if you had had bad experiences in buying used cars. But if your basic experiences in buying used cars had been good experiences, that would have had a little different kind of meaning. At the time that I first heard that, my problems were not in buying used cars, but in getting the car that I had repaired. And so my response was, yes, I would not particularly care to buy a used car from Nixon. I also would not want to take it to McGovern to get it repaired. Now, that again, you see, is based on experience. And for people who are either used car salesmen or automobile mechanics, are not at all flattering analogies, and will be more or less, the meaning of those will be more or less powerful for us in terms of our own personal experience. Okay. Now, primal experiences of interpersonal relationships are probably the more significant experiences for our religion and for our theology. Okay. Now, let me just try and summarize what I've been saying. Since we have a board, I'm just going to put it on here to try to visualize it. If we think of there being a screen in the universe, and this screen is God or ultimate reality, whatever you want to call it, whatever it is, for you. But it's a screen which is out there. Now, if I want to talk about God or what things are ultimately like, then I back here have my lens through which everything I say is filtered. That determines both the nature of that lens, determines both how I see what comes to me from the screen, and how I myself describe what it is that I see on the screen. Now, let's try a simple correlation from that. And that is, if you have your lens and I have my lens, we can both be looking at the same thing, talking about the same thing, but because we have different lenses, may not be able to understand one another very well, or are very likely to misunderstand one another. Illustration. I hope most of you are married. Okay? If you're not, I may run the risk of ruining something for you. What I run the risk of ruining for you is a particular kind of premarital counseling. Okay? One very interesting technique of premarital counseling is to say to the couple, well, you've done a lot of things together, you've talked a lot, you understand each other. Yeah. Well, one of the things you're going to have to do, of course, is furnish your house. Yes. Have you talked about that? Oh, yes, we like the same kind of things. Well, that's fine. Let's just engage in a little experiment here. I have here two sets of colors, you know, and I give them both these big color wheels you get from the paint shops, and I'd like to observe the way in which the two of you speak together about how you're going to furnish your house, and I'd like you to sit over here and you to sit over here, and I'll just sit here and kind of watch you. And so you give them you got the color wheels, you look at the colors, fine, all right. Now, let's start with the living room, all right. And what looks like it might be a good color for the wall. You're not going to have to live with this, but let's just, for the purposes of conversation, pick out what looks like a good color. And then the conversation begins. And of course, the catch is that as the conversation goes on, it becomes more and more confused and more conflicted because the colors do not correspond to each other. There are two sets of colors which are coded in such a way that when they are talking about this color, what looks good on looks like it will match on one wheel will not match on the other wheel. Now, if you can imagine people the kinds of conflicts that people would get into trying to furnish a house without seeing each other's color wheels, you know, and just using these very esoteric names that appear on color wheels. You can understand why it's sometimes so very difficult for us to talk with one another about those things which are of very ultimate significance and which are so determined by our own personal private experiences, which we often not only do not, but sometimes are unable to reveal to one another. Now, let's look at a particular, and this is now where I'd like to start, having laid out the assumptions, like to I want to make a transition now to talking about an actual theological question, which I consider to be pretty basic. But before I do, I'd just like to check and see if you have questions, or if you like to go back and look at one of the presuppositions. I'm not trying to assume that they're proved. I just like them to be out in the open and clarify. Yeah?
Using Our Father in the Lord's Prayer as an analogy, how much does that affect your attitude in relationship to God, using your own Father as the symbol or analogy that you speak of?
Well,
how do you overcome it if it is a negative?
How do you overcome it if it is a negative one? I think that's a very important point, and I would think that if our application of this particular method seems to be useful, we should come up with some possible responses to that question. But I'm not going to try to anticipate that. I'm not putting you off. I'm just delaying. But I think that we will have a response. Okay. If then you're willing to stay with the conversation in terms of these presuppositions, then let's take what should probably be the easiest and simplest point, and that is what Lutherans consider to be the most common and most basic point of entry into the relationship to God, and that is we in theological language call faith, and what we in 20th century English are more likely to call trust. When we say that we trust in God, or that we do not trust in God, how can we know the meaning of what we are saying? By our peace of mind? That would be a result. Would you expect there to be more trust or less trust?
Oh, I thought you meant how can I tell whether or not I'm totally trusting?
Ah, so you would feel that there would be, for you, trusting would give peace of mind.
That's what I meant.
Okay. Let me role play, right, a position. The position that I want to role play, and I want to come back to it after I pick up a couple of other comments, is that my peace of mind depends on not trusting in God. I'm going to role play that position.
I was going to say, wouldn't it depend on the idea of whether you thought you were the center of the universe, more or less, or whether there was somebody else out there that was, more powerful than you were? It seems like those are the two ideas. You think you can cut it all your own, or you think there's someone else up there that's more powerful than you.
Okay. That would be, again, a result of trusting or not trusting. Which would go with trust and which would go with not trusting?
Well, on one hand, it's kind of difficult to answer that, because if you trusted God, you may think you're more able to operate independently, whereas if you not, now you got me in a logical quandary, I think.
not logical. This is I want to say that I don't understand that I have put you into a logical quandary. I feel that I have, that you are indeed, in that it is a most difficult question, mm-hmm. but that the problem is not so much, is not basically a logical question, although it seems to be, but that it is the logic of experience that is makes that very difficult to respond to. Possibly because if you are anything like me, you have conflicting kinds of experience, so that you can answer it this way, and that seems very logical, and you can answer it that way, and it seems very logical. So what you have you have the religious conversation going on within yourself, and that doesn't reveal any basic flaw in your thinking, that you are engaged in thinking things which are absolutely contradictory, although in form, the logical form, they may seem to be, but that you are responding out of two kinds of experience. Perhaps if we could come back and role play this, this would be simpler to role play than for that reason than this would. I'm very interested. Would you mind talking a little bit about with me about trust and feeling at peace and so forth? I'm very interested to know that you feel that your trust in God gives you peace of mind. Right? Do I understand you correctly? And I also have the feeling that it's kind of difficult for you to understand that it's trusting in God that makes me uneasy.
Are you playing the role of an atheist?
Well, not of an atheist, no.
You believe that there is a God, then?
I believe that there is a God, oh yeah. Yeah. But that's a little difficult for you.
Well, I suppose it would depend on what you believe, what God means to you.
Okay. How could I go about finding out what God means to me?
No, I've often wondered that.
Okay. Mm. Well, I have too, and since it's my function to make those suggestions, let me try and take the risk of making one, and that is that one of the reasons that I have come to understand why trusting in God makes me uneasy is that I have difficulty in being critical of my parents. And
I don't understand.
Well, I have always been taught that we should love and respect our parents. And when I say things about my parents that do not seem loving and respectful, I just become kind of uneasy.
Well, what does that have to do with trusting in God?
Well, what your position would require me to say is that there's, if God is trustworthy, there's something wrong with my parents.
God gave you your parents.
Yes, I know He did. I'm firmly convinced of that, and I believe that they weren't trustworthy. I couldn't trust my parents. Well, I don't know whether I can trust God or not. But if I can trust God, then my parents were not, and if I can trust God and I can trust my parents, then my parents weren't very godly. A lot of them that aren't. You know some other parents who were not trustworthy? Aha. Uh-huh. It takes a long time.
All this time I've been listening and believing that what they say, being Swedish, that is the law, and it's got to do that way, and there just aren't any choices.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the point where you get some other information and start making your own decisions much too late sometimes.
Uh-huh.
This is not too late, this is too late. Find out there's somebody even bigger than your parents that maybe should be controlling your life, and looking past your parents and realizing that they, like yourself, are also imperfect, that you don't have to do exactly what they say anymore, especially the kinds of things you have learned are not according to God's will, as you see it and have learned, and from your own experience, and from the experience of what they have done negatively, I think maybe of anger, and what that some parents feel that they're justified in being angry against sin to the point where whatever they do to make you fall in line with their way of thinking justifies their anger because of how they project it upon you. Physical punishment, maybe, or making you feel guilty by what they say, maybe not even saying anything, like you tucker it off all by yourself. Okay?
It's a...
Leaving you there.
Mm-hmm.
Very seldom the why in our court. Just a straight out, this is it, I said so.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask me any more questions.
It's a pretty difficult insight to come to.
So then, I guess I'm thinking that as well. The transition then of coming to realize that God, the Father, is a just God, and that you're not going to get that kind of punishment, and then to realize fully and accept fully the personal relationship of his and his son to take the place of our sins sometimes is just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of awareness, and I'm going to assume for the moment that others of us, I don't know what percentage, but that others of us understand that experience, that each of us has our own individual experience of coming to understand that our parents are not entirely trustworthy. We aren't either. So all of our children will have that same experience. Yeah. Now, yes.
I've had a good trusting relationship with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a physician. I'm thinking now of two families who I've had some contact with. A father who was a wife beater and a child beater, and in the heat of anger killed another man and ended up in our...
Can't hear you.
A father who was a child beater and a wife beater, along with that, lost his temper and killed another man and ended up in our state penitentiary. The mother is supporting the child, who is now about 11 or 12. This happened when he was 5 or 6. He's a nice little fellow, but very furtive expression on his face. He doesn't seem to trust any man, including his doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that happened 2 years ago, a woman of 41 with the youngest child, 8, the second youngest is going to be confirmed, and just before Easter she took off with a man 11 years her junior. And the father in that instance is keeping the family together. The disparity between these two families and their observations of the role of mother and father and the trust that they can have for either the father or the mother, depending on which one had gone astray.
Okay.
It makes one wonder, and thank God every night for his own secure background. Mm-hmm. Realize that about 25 to 30% of the families don't have that secure background. Another 25 or 30% have a disharmonious relationship with that guy between their mother and father. So that only about 50% of us are lucky as I am.
All right. Now that's, I'd like just to interrupt here, and because the bell has rung, but take the liberty of just...
that's a trick to a sermon.
Oh, well, that's not. Oh, okay, thank you. All right. I'm sorry I interrupted. But let me just try and summarize where I understand this to be. What we have been talking about in terms of some specific examples that I'm sure all of us could duplicate from our observations, and at least some of us from personal experience, is that parents are not always trustworthy. Not always. And that probably parents are never trustworthy in the sense in which we theologically assert that God can be trusted in every situation. Now, my personal experience, however that may be, my personal experience of the trustworthiness or untrustworthiness of my parents will influence the way in which I relate not only to other people, to my doctor, but also influence the way in which I relate to God. Now, if you say to me that you trust God and find God always to be trustworthy, and that gives you peace of mind, and I am still coming to terms, to return to the role play, still coming to terms with my relationship to my parents, then it may be very difficult for me to assert that God is always trustworthy. And that assertion will have different meanings, dimensions of meaning for me than for you. Because I, for example, then find myself in the position of saying some things about my parents which my parents may have forbidden me to say. To say that they are in some way less than perfect, to say that they cannot always be trusted. And those of us who have personal experiences of coming to that awareness in a somewhat more painful way can understand that that could be very painful. So that while on one level the logic of saying God is trustworthy seems to be perfectly clear, given the experiential context, it could, for someone in the position that I am trying to present, it could be a statement that it would be very difficult and painful for me to make, and that I might find myself denying because of the difficulty and pain of making it. Because every time I make that, I have to say, my parents are somewhat less than God, are not perfectly trustworthy.
That they're not like God? That they're not... Does any parent deny the fact that they're imperfect? Everybody admits he makes mistakes occasionally.
No.
I don't know. I have been blessed with beautiful parents. I don't have this problem. I maybe can't relate to them.
There has to have been a time in your life when your parents said that they would do something, no matter how minor, and didn't carry through. You know, I mean, all of our intentions, I can tell my daughter we will go somewhere and do something, and then maybe something comes up that is more pressing for a family relationship. But as a child, she can't comprehend, you know, the reason that I have to back out on the promise that I made.
And that makes you untrustworthy.
To her, in her eyes, even though, you know, it's something very, very minor and unimportant. But to her, at her age, that's a very important thing. If I promise to take her to the park and don't take her, boy, the end of the earth, you know.
Well, that's just exactly why we need a Heavenly Father, in my mind.
Mm-hmm. I've heard many people who are sort of let down in many or most of their relationships, who would just sort of be thrown to God, and not because of the analogy, but because of something else they feel that they needed, something that they could ultimately trust in. Therefore, say they trust in God, and they don't go through this lens bit or whatever, or they don't say God is like my father or whatever, but God is God, and I trust in Him, and this other bit doesn't either impede them, it may project them into that relationship.
Where do the meanings of trusting and not trusting come from?
Yeah, well, do they necessarily have to come because of one's parents?
Not, perhaps not.
Yeah, I mean, I have feelings of trust in friends.
Mm-hmm.
I also did in my parents in some way. I never felt that they weren't vulnerable as I became more adult, I realized that they were vulnerable and made mistakes and were sinful or whatever.
But there was, you can then also remember or at least imagine a time when you felt that your parents and God were almost identical?
I can't remember.
You
can. Isn't the difference that our parents, you know, our parents are human and God is divine? And, you know, the two don't mesh, really.
Parents can make good decisions for the benefit of the child. It causes the child not to trust them. We had one child that didn't especially want to come home. And we made him, and he's really liked it. Now, I suppose momentarily he maybe didn't trust us for making such what he thought at that time a dumb decision. And I think that's part of the danger then with God. If we think trust means he's going to do good things for us, we're going to always have a wonderful life. And then, of course, there's inevitably tragedy and so forth. We're misinterpreting what trust should be because we don't really know what is best. And I think we have to be very careful to trust. We don't mistake trust to mean everything happy ending to everything.
And also in making decisions for our children and in having had our parents make decisions for us, recognize that well-intentioned decisions might not turn out to be the best. I mean, I'm happy that it worked out well for you.
I wasn't trying to play God in that role.
No.
But I'm saying God can make, you know, makes decisions that are best for us, and they don't look like they are to us, but who are we to say?
And you are playing the role there of uneasy in the trust of God. Maybe you are uneasy in what ultimate reality is.
That may very well be.
So the question is, what is God?
Mm-hmm. Oh, see, what?
A few years ago, I opened up a Life magazine, and I saw an article that said, "What if God is black?" by Robert Kennedy after his trip to Africa. Another analogy.
Yeah. Okay. Now, it's very, very common religious language, at least in the Christian community, to say to people, God is like your parents. Particularly, God is like your father, but also I think God is like your parents. That is not accidental, it seems to me, that one of the realities of the small child is that the small child wants his parents to be like God, right? His mother to be the best cook, his father to be the strongest man in the neighborhood, his parents to know everything. That's important for the security of the child. Okay? Yes.
Do we really do that? Haven't we been trying to put down the knowledge that the feeling that people have said to little kids, God is this great white figure with a great white beard? I don't know if I can go along with that. I really think that we have said that God is, we say our Father who art in heaven, but I don't know whether we really have really felt that God is like our Father. You know, we've had this other kind of old man image that we tried to break away with. I don't know. I wasn't brought up, particularly in a Christian home, I don't think that I was brought up. I was not brought up in a Christian home in a sense, although my parents went to church and so did I. I became a Christian as an adult. But nevertheless, you know, there was this God figure, and no way did I think he was like my parents.
I certainly hope my children don't consider me to be any kind of a God. I hope they don't compare me to God, because I make a lot of mistakes, and I...
Our mother.
Well, whatever. Parents in any way, shape, or form. I certainly hope my children give more trust to God than they do to me.
But do you want them to say that God and you are completely dissimilar?
Well, in a lot of ways. Not that I want it that way.
But they learn trust first from us.
I'm an ambassador of God, I feel, to my children. But they're older now. When they were little, I don't know. I don't think I ever, I hope I never gave them the impression that I was any kind of a God figure to them.
No, but you're superior to them.
Superior, yes, as a parent.
All right. So is God superior to us?
Okay. Yeah. Sheila?
Yeah. I've been musing about all this. It's occurred to me, number one, that may be a really lousy image, but I thought of that before. I mean, God the Father, I think in a lot of ways that's been a destructive image, perhaps. I think that it's very old, and it comes from a time when the Father was in fact the authoritarian, absolute head of everything. I think our image of God has remained highly authoritarian. I think it might have changed if we thought of God as our mother. I mean, I think that brings a different image to most mm-hmm. people from their experience as children, even. And it gets quite complex, but it's very interesting to think around about that and what that means, and what it imbues the human analogous figure with. What does it do for a father figure to have God described as father? I mean, that works both ways, it seems to me. Aside from one's own experience of parent, that's a whole other thing. You know, I was really struck by that. What does it mean when you have had extremely difficult and untrustworthy relationships with parents, this particularly father, to say, our Father who art in heaven? You know, on some other level, what does that do? But mm-hmm. also just the fact that's a male image is an interesting thing to think about.
Uh-huh. So you'd like to see more experience with mothers or with females introduced into our common religious language, you think?
Yes, and I think that's extremely difficult to do. You don't just... Yes, because it has to do with role, even as they've been experienced in the past. I think the roles have changed, are changing. The very authoritarian image of God is one that, I don't know whether that's so useful.
Leave out the sex analogy. This is our God, which is in heaven.
Okay. This is a good place to break off the discussion.